It's an exciting time to research dinosaurs in Alaska. Paleontologists are uncovering new species of polar dinosaurs unique to this region that could help unlock mysteries about dinosaurs overall. I'm Annie Feit. This fall, scientists described an entirely new species of duck-billed dinosaur that lived on Alaska's North Slope 70 million years ago, and they expect many more discoveries to come. We're digging into dinosaurs today on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
A few decades ago, dinosaurs and Alaska were two words that generally did not go together. Today, scientists are combing through treasure troves of dinosaur tracks and bones at several sites around the state and making new discoveries along the way. We'll talk about those discoveries and opportunities, and we'd love to hear from you. What do you want to know about dinosaurs in Alaska? Give us a call at 1-800-478-8255. Or if you're in Anchorage, 550-8422. You can always email us at talk@alaskapublic.org. My two guests today are responsible for most of the recent dinosaur work in the state. Greg Erickson is a former Anchorage resident who's a paleobiologist at Florida State University. Hi, Greg.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. And Pat Druckenmiller is Earth Sciences Curator at the University of Alaska Museum of the North, where there's currently an exhibit called Expedition Alaska Dinosaurs. Hi, Pat.
Hello, how are you?
Good. And let me start with you. Why was it that Alaska didn't used to be considered a good spot to look for dinosaurs?
Well, Alaska has been sort of off the grid in a lot of respects. A lot of things that have happened up here have happened late relative to what maybe have happened down in the lower 48 or in Canada. So we had not really been considered to be a likely place to find much dinosaurs. Even though we had a good sense of the geology of the state, there was sort of an underlying belief that, well, you know, at Alaska, it's way up north. Why would you expect to find dinosaurs way the heck up there? And it was sort of coupled also with the fact that there's not a lot of easy real estate it's not easy to get around Alaska. And then even if you are good at that, there's not a lot of big expanse of areas of, say, badlands, which were typically places we go to look for dinosaurs. So really just Alaska just wasn't on the radar for a long time.
And then what changed?
Well, essentially, the state did get increasingly more explored, and there was some interest. First of all, there were discoveries made of dinosaurs from the Arctic realm and other places. For example, in places like in Spitsbergen and Svalbard, Norway, where there's some dinosaur tracks that were found up there. And then there were some dinosaur bones found in the Canadian Arctic. So people started to say, hey, you know, maybe this whole idea of dinosaurs way up north isn't so crazy. In Alaska specifically, what happened was there was a geologist named Robert Liscombe who was doing some geologic mapping along the Colville River in northern Alaska up on the North Slope. He was basically sent out by an oil company to look at the rocks, and in the process of looking at these rocks, he discovered a bunch of bones weathering out of a hillside. And he wasn't a paleontologist, so he picked them up and said, hey, I found these bones. Well, I think there might be mammalian. So he sent them back to the corporate office. And that's sort of where it ended for quite a long time, until eventually there was the bones were re-examined. And when that happened, the person who looked at them, now this would be in the early 80s, realized, well, these don't really look like mammal bones. I think they're dinosaurs. He sent them off to a few other people. And eventually, by now about the middle 1980s, it was realized that, in fact, these were dinosaur bones. And they were beautiful dinosaur bones. And so then effort was then, through our museum and the University of California, Berkeley, we joined forces, and The first proper dinosaur expedition into Alaska was launched in 1987. And they headed up to the Colville River and were able to relocate this site where these bones were first found by Robert Liscombe in 1961 when he first found them.
Wow.
And that became now the basis for the first real proper recognition that, hey, there are dinosaurs in Alaska, and not only in Alaska, but in northern Alaska. And that was a really big, exciting revelation.
And is that's the same site where you and Greg still do most of your work?
That's correct. Our museum has been basically working up on the North Slope now since the late 1980s. We haven't done trips with the University of California, Berkeley, for quite a while now. But yes, we've been up there most years for over two decades. And one of the sites that we have excavated many bones out of is the bone bed that Robert Liscombe found. And we now call that the Liscombe bone bed. So a bone bed is basically a layer of rock just full of, in this case, literally thousands and thousands of bones. And the layer of rock is only, 2-3 feet thick, but it's got literally hundreds of thousands of bones in it. But it takes a long time and many years to excavate quite a bit of material from this layer. And that's what we've done. And now at our museum in Fairbanks, we have over 6,000 bones from that one site alone, which is a pretty respectable number.
And Greg, can you just describe that site a little more? I mean, how big of an area are we talking about, and how rich is it in terms of dinosaur bones?
Well, it's a layer just above the Colville River waterline, and it's several hundred meters long. It pops out here and there along the bank, and a few feet deep. And when you go up to it, you immediately see bones that have fallen out of the hill from erosion, from the winter storms and all that sort of stuff, and erosion. And you start digging, and the bones are just stacked like cordwood. It's amazing, and the bones are just remarkably well preserved up there. There's hardly any what we call permineralization. In other words, there hasn't been a lot of minerals seeping into the bones that tend to make them a lot, less like modern bones. In other words, making them really heavy and whatnot. And as you start digging in there, you just find them stacked like cordwood. Most of the dinosaurs are young animals, leaving quite a mystery as to what happened here. What was the disaster that killed all these animals? And along the way, we find all kinds of bite marks in the bones. We find tyrannosaur teeth. We find raptor teeth. All kinds of remains of creatures that were feeding upon these animals who shed or lost their teeth while they were doing it. It's pretty remarkable. One thing about the site you have to be careful is that the cliffs tend to collapse, and you have to be very careful that you be wary of collapsing cliffs while we're working. So it's a little bit perilous, but as scientists, we're willing to take the gamble, so to speak.
Yeah, I saw a video from the Museum of the North that it looks incredibly perilous. But it's worth it, huh?
Oh, that's why we get paid the big bucks. that is a joke.
Yeah. So this fall, you both published a journal article describing a new species of dinosaur discovered at this site. Why don't one of you say the name of the dinosaur?
Sure, this is
Pat.
the name of it is Agrunuluk kukpikensis, which are root words that come from Inupiaq language, the native language of the native peoples up there. The Agruna refers to an animal with a large set of, or with a set of grinding teeth, so some kind of an herbivorous animal with grinding teeth. And the Aluk ending refers to sort of gives it a great antiquity, or it makes it sort of ancient. So it's an ancient chewer. And then Kukpik is the native name for the Colville River. So it's the ancient chewer of the Colville River. And the reason that makes sense is because this dinosaur is a member of a group of dinosaurs called duck-billed dinosaurs, or hadrosaurs. And they're a really fascinating group of large plant eaters that were very common during this period of time, during the late Cretaceous period. And what's really unique about them is that they have a very distinctive set of grinding teeth. Basically, they have hundreds of teeth in their mouth, but they're formed into a set of four what we call dental batteries. So each in, say, the lower left jaw, all the teeth are basically grow together to form a large grinding surface that rubs against the upper left jaw, which is a similar sort of a setup. So they effectively have these giant grinding dentitions, this teeth in their mouth that is useful for chewing vegetation, which isn't something normally we think of reptiles doing is chewing. But in this case of hadrosaurs, they actually had the capacity to chew, and so the name made good sense to be an ancient chewer.
And when did you first get the sense that you might be looking at a new species of dinosaur?
This is Pat again. Basically, the bones that had been collected over the years up there for a long time we knew they were duck-billed dinosaurs, and we'd been collecting them for, literally, almost two decades worth of collections. And in the process of doing that, we basically found every single bone in the body, in fact, many times over. In trying to figure out what they were, they clearly looked like this other kind of dinosaur known from more lower latitudes, like in Montana and Alberta, called Edmontosaurus, which is a pretty appropriate name for a dinosaur from Alberta. And for a long time, we just said, well, we think they're Edmontosaurus. But in all that time, there hadn't been any serious effort to sit there and look at all the really gory little details that makes, of our Alaskan species to see if it was the same thing as Edmontosaurus or something different. And so I had a PhD student named Hiro Mori who took this on as his project starting in about 2008. And he spent a lot of time looking at all of these bones in all their gory detail, flying to museums literally all over the world to compare our Alaskan material to species from elsewhere. And the biggest single challenge that he had to overcome, and that we all did in this study, was if you want to identify a new type of duck-billed dinosaur, it's preferable to do that on an adult-sized animal. Adults show all those distinctive features. But most of our material were from young animals, from juveniles, and they don't always show all the features. So if you see a feature that's maybe different on our Alaskan dinosaur, we'd say, well, maybe it's different, but maybe it's just young and it hasn't developed that feature yet. So that was a big part of the job, was to figure out if the features we saw were features just of a juvenile or of a known species, or if they were something different. And to make a long story short, we had a couple of different ways of approaching that. And eventually, we looked at sort of growth trajectories of features by comparing with younger individuals of known species. And we also had, over time, collected some pretty important bones from larger, near adult-sized individuals. And at the end of the day, we said, you know what? When we look at the sum of all the differences, and these are details of anatomy in the skull, we could see that there were clearly, we could definitely say that our Alaskan species was not Edmontosaurus. In fact, there's two species of Edmontosaurus, and it was clearly neither of those two species, which left us with saying, well, is it like anything else in the world? And it isn't. It's very much a different, unique. It has a unique combination of features that are distinctive of this species. So we felt, okay, this is a good basis for naming a new species, and that's what we did.
And what are the most prominent, like, this is a different species features?
Oh, specifically, one of the bones up in the front part of the mouth called the premaxilla. It's a bone that's typically used in deciding, looking for differences in different species of duckbills. And we had actually three different size classes of this bone in our animal. And it did not resemble in some very important features in terms of particular ridges, for example, the premaxilla of Edmontosaurus and any other species. So that was one of them. And another really critical bone was a bone right above the eye called the postorbital, which had it lacked actually a really distinctive feature of Edmontosaurus. So it was kind of a sum of a variety of features like that.
And Greg, what do we know about how this dinosaur survived so far north?
Well, actually, not much. And that's really what Pat and I are trying to, the mystery that Pat and I are trying to solve. How is it possible that dinosaurs, what we typically think of as reptiles, how could they possibly survive up in conditions that were, as near as we can tell back then, about 43 degrees Fahrenheit average annual temperature. It was cold enough to snow on these animals. They had experienced between 3 and 5 months of complete darkness. So it's quite a mystery as to how they survived up there. And so part of our work is trying to figure out what kind of plants were up there that they might have been able to feed upon, you know, basically reconstructing the environment. We're looking at whether or not these animals were migrating up there, say, during spring and summer, and then returning when the cold months came and darkness came, maybe migrating down to Alberta versus being up there year-round. So you know, these are some of the, you know, mysteries we're trying to solve. The neat thing about having dinosaurs up there, it's a natural test of dinosaur physiology. We don't normally associate reptiles with environments like that. Dinosaurs are typically portrayed as being sort of tropical animals, equatorial kinds of creatures, I guess, would be the equivalent settings you'd see reptiles in today. But that's not what it was like up there. It was probably like more like British Columbia or something like that. A good analogy for what the temperatures were like and up there. Yeah, dinosaurs were there, and we're not finding. What's interesting is what we're not finding. We're not finding crocodiles. We're not finding turtles. We're not finding amphibians. These are cold-blooded animals. Instead, we're finding mammals, birds, and dinosaurs, which are all warm-blooded. And so, as I referred to, being a natural test of their physiology. This supports the theory, one that I hold and a lot of other dinosaur paleontologists hold, and that's that dinosaurs were actually warm-blooded creatures. They were more like birds and mammals in terms of how they regulated their temperature. In other words, they didn't rely on the sun to basically, you know, get warmed up and be active each day. In other words, they were capable of generating heat from the food that they ate. So it's we're really just getting started on that end of the research. Part of I've worked with Pat for 6 years up there now, and part of it is just, you know, we've been up there trying to collect new specimens and try to get material that we can start conducting studies to figure out what was up there and basically how they lived up there.
And is the theory that dinosaurs were warm-blooded, is that a pretty new theory?
No, not really. I guess probably about, I would say the 1960s, people started suggesting that might be the case. At first, it was viewed with, frankly, considerable disdain by the researchers that had traditionally thought of dinosaurs as being typical reptiles in terms of their physiology. But slowly, as you know, basically through the 70s and mostly through the 80s, most paleontologists started thinking of these animals as being more bird-like or somewhere in between. And so I'd say most dinosaur paleontologists believe that dinosaurs had some sort of a physiology that was certainly elevated above that of living reptiles, and that they were probably what we call endotherms, animals that could basically make their own energy or basically get heat from the food that they consumed and that sort of thing. So, but it's hard to test these kinds of ideas, and that's what's neat about working up in Alaska for us. It's, like I said, it's a natural experiment. It's sort of like, well, what if you took dinosaurs and dropped them in a cold weather environment? Mm-hmm. Well, lo and behold, we have that test. And so it's, that's one of the wonderful things about, you know, having those specimens up there. We hopefully we'll crack the code on that, and hopefully the Alaskan dinosaurs will help, give us the final answer about what dinosaurs were really like.
And you talked a little bit about how it was warmer up there at that time, but can you give us more of a sense of what the Alaska looked like 70 million years ago?
Why don't you take that one, Pat?
Pat? Oh, we might have lost
him. I think we lost him. I'll take it.
Okay. It's all you, Greg.
Okay. Yeah. So a couple things to realize about Alaska 70 million years ago. First of all, the site we're working on is at 70 north latitude. In the age of dinosaurs, it was actually up about 85 degrees north. So, I mean, these dinosaurs were literally, you know, living up there with Santa Claus. And that's, you know, part of the reason there was so much darkness that they had to deal with. The world as a whole back then was much warmer. Up there it was about 43 degrees Fahrenheit average annual temperature, so it's considerably warmer than it is today up there, but still cool for relative to what we expect reptiles, kind of environment reptiles would normally be living in. We know there was a boreal forest up there, so there were conifer trees, there were some flowering plants as well, there were lots of horsetails, and frankly, some plants that we haven't quite figured out what they are. So we're trying to reconstruct that as well. It was basically a forested environment. It had lots of braided streams and rivers that ran down through it. The Brooks Range was just starting to push up. It was nowhere near as tall as it is today, but it was just beginning to push up, and the rivers and streams came down from it, and they were loaded with sediment from the erosion of this newly erupted mountain range. And it's that sediment that actually was burying these dinosaurs and made it possible for us to find them. If an animal dies, you need to get it buried very quickly if it's going to fossilize. And, of course, an animal the size of a dinosaur requires a lot of sediment. And it's just, all the stars lined up in this case with having dinosaurs and, lots of water and the mountain range being pushed up. It created a situation that preserved these creatures so we could actually discover them today.
Okay, we are talking about dinosaurs on Talk of Alaska today. If you have a question about dinosaurs in Alaska, give us a call at 1-800-478-8255. You can, if you're in Anchorage, you can dial 550-8422 or email us at talk@alaskapublic.org. My guest today, Greg Erickson, is with us. He's a paleobiologist at Florida State University. And also Pat Druckenmiller is the Earth Sciences Curator at the University of Alaska Museum of the North. And Pat, are you back with us?
We are back.
Yes. Oh, great. Welcome back. I wanted to talk a little bit more about this field work. You both spoke about the perils of what you do at this site. Can you kind of describe a little more, like, what does it take to uncover these bones?
This is Pat. I can start in on that. Mm-hmm. Sure. the first challenge is just getting there. And in order to, say, reach our sites up on the North Slope, involves, first of all, a rather arduous drive down up the Hall Road for about 500 miles and in a university truck or two. And then we unload all of our gear, which includes things like two boats and outboard motors and food for a couple of weeks and all of the necessary gear for digging, which amounts to actually a couple of tons. And we load all this into small aircraft and fly out to the Colville River and land on a gravel bar. But that's interesting because it often we make plans to go out on particular days, but we seldomly actually get there on those days because weather and other constraints from the charter companies tend to make flying out on any schedule sort of tricky. So we've been out there actually 3-4 days later than we left 3 or 4 days later than planned in many occasions just because of delays like this. Once we get out to the field site, we set up a camp on a gravel bar. And we put our boats together, and it's tundra. So if we want to get around up there, we need a boat. And so we use small inflatable boats with outboard motors to get up and down the river. And that, of course, comes with its own set of challenges and risks. We spend our days basically walking along the base of bluffs of rocky outcrops, looking at the ground and seeing if we can see bones sticking out or maybe bones that have already weathered out that are laying on the beach, trying to find the source of those bones in the hill up above. And then we can get into actually starting to dig. And digging is, of course, it's very challenging there. Greg already mentioned the fact that these bluffs they're unstable. One of the big reasons they're unstable is because the actual quote-unquote rock is very soft when it's in sort of normal conditions, but it's all frozen. It's permafrost area. And during warm summer days, the the face of these bluffs can warm up quite a bit, and the large chunks of the bluff can suddenly unexpectedly let loose and come tearing down the hill slope, which is kind of terrifying.
Right. Yeah.
We try to take precautions for that, and we often will do even several days of work on the slope above our field sites to make sure we knock down the hill to make sure it's stabilized.
It's like avalanche control work for...
Exactly. It's avalanche control work and without the explosives, yeah.
Yeah, and then how do you actually get, once you find a bone, how do you get it out of the ground?
Well, hopefully the bones aren't actually... if we dig in about 3 feet or so, we'll actually get back into the permafrost. But usually the outer couple of feet of the slope is melted. So when we find a bone, what we'll do is we'll cover it with a protective jacket, a plaster jacket, as we call it. It's 19th century technology. We take a bucket of plaster and take a big strip of burlap and dip it in and then wrap it around the bone. Huh. It's pretty much that simple. The problem is when it's 31 degrees and sleeting, plaster doesn't like to set all the time. And your fingers, of course, are rather chilly at this point. So it's not like making a plaster jacket anywhere else. Greg and I are both familiar with doing this kind of work in the, 100-degree weather in the Badlands of maybe Montana. It's a different story in Alaska altogether.
Yeah. So how do you do that with your frozen fingers and frozen material?
we get cold. we're often doing this work and with pretty much all the clothes on that we can put on, and that time of year is also very wet. That's really kind of the wettest part of the year for the North Slope. So we're dealing with rainy, snowy, sleety conditions, and so we put on a lot of clothes. We do get cold, and at the end of the day, we've learned some little tricks to make sure the plaster sets. Some little techniques that we've picked up here and there. We don't always need to use plaster. We use other like just big. We use aluminum foil, actually. It's a great way to get a lot of bones out of the ground, and you don't have to wait for the plaster to set, things like that.
Okay, we have one caller on the line from the Mat-Su Valley. Hi, Ron. You're on Talk of Alaska.
Good morning. My name's Ron Mansil, and Kaduziak's my Inupiaq name, but... And I applaud your efforts, and I really respect the fact that you consulted with the local indigenous folks of the region in order to name your new species that you discovered. I'm really excited about that, just in itself. And, I spent a couple field seasons up there at the Liskin site, and can relate to a lot of the fun and adventure folks have had through the years doing that at the Liskin site. A lot of folks know this, but it was when I found the Kikak Kaduziak site way back in the 97 or 99, I was working with Roland Gangloff and Dr. Dave Norton, and I found the site and they verified it. There was some new species that came out of that site. One was named after H. Ross Perot. I don't remember the exact scientific name of it.
Pachyrhinosaurus perorum.
Exactly. There you go.
Yeah. I'm so proud of that. And I'm always excited to talk about it. And I love the adventure. I love the science behind it. And I love the stories that come out of that science. When you tell the story. Like, with Liskin site, I always enjoyed the theoretical hypothesis that Tony Fiorello came up with about they were trying to cross a swollen Kupik River back then. It was all muddy, and a lot of them got stuck in the mud. And then when they're stuck in the mud, then a lot of the other carnivores came along and chewed on them and left behind their teeth and remains, too, for pretty good folks to uncover. I just wanted to say thank you to everybody. I mean, I worked with a whole lot of folks out in the field, people like Kevin May and Dr. Dave Norton and Linda Katsasis and Joanne Avery. There's so many great people and personalities and the people in the Wixit Barrow and folks in Dead Horse. I mean, there's so many people that are involved in the whole process in order to try to understand Alaska's early history. And I'm really proud of it, and I'm really proud of the things and the stuff you guys do. I just want to say thank you.
Okay. Oh, great. Thanks, Ron.
Thank you for the nice call, and that's fantastic.
Yeah, Ron, I don't think we've ever met in person, but of course I'm familiar with your name and your discovery of the Keekak-Tegosiak bed that's produced two new species of dinosaurs now from the North Slope, the big plant-eater Pachyrhinosaurus, Peroorum, that you mentioned, as well as a species of a tyrannosaur that was named Nanuksaurus.
Nice.
Yeah, that's great. I'm glad that you had a chance to call in and hear the show. It brings up a good point too, that the work that Greg and I are doing up there now is we're in a long line of people who have worked up on the slope and collected all these bones over the years, and we're all part of kind of a continuum, and there's been a lot of really a lot of really great people who've worked up there. So thanks for your call.
Well, I thank you very much. I just I had one question for you, sir, and that was: do you think there's a connection between the migrations of the hadrosaurs between here and like the I forgot where it's in Canada, Alberta, where they've got the museum dug right in the side of the hill where they dig them up? you think there might be a connection? And that's all I got to say. And I thank you very much. And y'all folks have a good day.
Hey, thanks, Ron.
Greg, you want to take that one?
Yeah, I'll take that one. That's more along my line. So the question is, were these animals migrating up there? At least with regard to our duckbill dinosaur, I don't think so. One of the ways we're approaching this is we're looking at the growth of this animal. And so with dinosaurs, you can cut open their bones, and we have lots of bones from this thing, as Pat just said. And inside, you find growth lines. So these are very much like the growth lines that we use for instance, I use down here to age alligators. They're annual growth lines, and you can count those up. And from that, you can get an idea how old these animals were. But you can also come up with a growth curve for the creature, and that's what I'm working on right now. And my preliminary evidence looking at the growth curve of this animal versus growth curves of the what we thought were the equivalents down in Alberta is that this animal is growing in a very different fashion. A second thing that I've been looking at are the teeth, and Pat and I published a paper on this. The teeth from our duckbill dinosaur in Alaska, if you cut them open, they have a very bizarre signature. They have these really accentuated growth lines in the teeth that we don't see in animals at lower latitudes, and it seems to be an Arctic signal. And what's happened is the biorhythms are very different, and anyone can relate that lives up in Alaska with so much darkness in the winter and that sort of thing. Physiological biorhythms get accentuated in very northern environments, and that seems to be what we're seeing in the teeth as well. We just do not see that in any of the more southern specimens. And also, we'd expect a mix of teeth that have developed that don't show it, and then also start showing these growth bands, the accentuated growth bands, if they'd migrated during the year. And that's not what we're seeing. So everything seems to suggest that these animals were up there year round, and I suspect that's what we're going to find. Also, some of the animals we're finding up there are quite small, and I find it hard to believe that they could have migrated all the way down to Alberta and back each year, that sort of thing. So I think, at least with regard to our duckbill, that this animal was up there year-round. We're going to be looking at the other animals that we've been collecting lots of bones of over the last few years to do similar kinds of studies as well. And this paints a different picture of dinosaurs. They were able to tolerate freezing conditions, and we were trying to figure out what they fed upon, if they did feed at all through some of these spans in the winter. That's part of the mystery, and that's the fun of our science too. Is that one of the fun things about our discoveries so far is it actually has opened up more questions than have been answered, and that's great because it gives paleontologists like us something to do. And it's going to provide a lifetime of questions for us and for, you know, young budding paleontologists out there in society. There's going to be plenty to do when we're done as well. I'm hoping we can answer some of the big questions we're after, but honestly, it's going to take many years, and I'm not sure we'll get to all of them before we're done with our careers.
Wow. Well, this is fascinating stuff. We need to take a quick break, but we'll hear more about dinosaurs in Alaska as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by
the University of Alaska Southeast, with schools of arts and sciences, management, education, and career education in Juneau, Ketchikan, and Sitka. UAS, a learning community on campus and online. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. I'm Annie Feit, and today we're discussing dinosaurs. My guest today, Pat Druckenmiller, he's Earth Sciences Curator at the University of Alaska Museum of the North. Greg Erickson is a paleobiologist at Florida State University, and we'll have more from them in a few minutes. But first, I want to turn to Ann Posh. She's a retired paleontologist who co-founded the Alaska Museum of Science and Nature in Anchorage. If you want to see dinosaur bones up close in this city, that's the place to go. Hi, Anne.
Hello, good morning.
And what types, can you kind of describe what types of dinosaur discoveries you made during your career at UAA?
Well, I got to work on a few little exciting things. One of them was the discovery of a hadrosaur in the Talkeetna Mountains, which, unlike the Colville River site, this was within about 100 feet of a major highway. So this was an incredible find, and it was the first dinosaur ever found in the Talkeetna Mountains. And it was also a very unusual hadrosaur because it is much older. At first, I thought it must be an Edmontosaurus, which at that time was what they thought the bones from the North Slope were. And, of course, now they have shown that that's a different species than we originally thought. And we still don't know what species we have in the Talkeetna Mountains because we don't have the skull. We never found the skull. It was unusual because it was found in a marine sediment. So this dinosaur didn't die and get buried on land. It actually sank into a shallow sea. At that time, the predecessor of Cook Inlet extended up into the Matanuska Valley. And so this animal was found with marine creatures like ammonites and other types of shellfish. So that was a very exciting find. And I also worked with Pat's predecessor, Roland Gangloff, up on the North Slope, and we did two excursions down the Colville looking for dinosaur tracks and found they were there probably by the hundreds. They haven't been totally studied yet, but that was before Pat and his group discovered tracks along along the Colville River. And along the Yukon River, sorry about that.
Right.
When we started our little museum in 1994, there wasn't much known at that time. We knew about the North Slope discoveries, a little bit about them, but we had the feeling that there were just absolutely fabulous things to be found in the state of Alaska. I mean, we have the most volcanoes of any state. We have the most and largest glaciers, of course, the biggest mountains. We have such natural wonders in this state, and we just felt that there should be a museum in the population center that educated people about the state's fabulous resources. And we were certainly right, because since 1994, there have been so many more discoveries. and new ones all the time, the discoveries in the Denali Park. So we have a big job to try to cover all this material.
Yeah, so what can people see at the exhibit?
Well, we have not only dinosaurs, but we have birds and animals, whales. We have a mounted whale that was assembled by two physicians who live here in town. We have an exhibit on the Ice Age. We have rocks and minerals. We have birds. We have a children's section where children can come and dig their own dinosaurs. As far as dinosaur exhibits, we have fabulous paintings by James Havens, who's an artist who's done work for Pat Druckenmiller. And from what I have seen around the country, his paintings are equal to the best across the country. He's absolutely fabulous.
And
he also, he also built a life-size model of a pterosaur. There was a pterosaur track found in Denali Park, and he recreated this creature, which is now hanging in the museum. We also have, I think right now, the only mounted dinosaur in the state. It is not a species found here, but it is very similar. It is a juvenile hadrosaur that was found in Montana, but it is a mounted skeleton. It's not the real thing. It's a cast. And so that is on display, which is unique to the state. And I think Pat's trying to correct that. I think he's planning to mount skeleton, is that right?
We have three skeletons of a Grunuluk that are literally being assembled at this very moment in our museum. The skeletal mounts are complete, and they're just being final touches being put on them before installing them in front of this new painting by James Havens depicting a scene in northern Alaska when a Grunuluk lived about 69 million years ago.
Okay, and I should mention that we actually have a web comment from James Havens, and he talks about his work a little bit, and then I guess he wants either of you, to talk about that relationship between artists and the science. How does that work?
This is Pat. I'm happy to chat about that. I think there's a really natural connection between art and science that in this case is it's really critical, I think, working with artists because like James Havens and also like Ray Troll as well from Ketchikan, who's also done some dinosaur paintings of Alaskan material. We describe these bones, and as paleontologists we get into these little subtle nuances of bone anatomy and things that get us all excited and the rest of the world kind of, you know, the lids drop and they fall back asleep. But if it really takes an artist to bring these things to life, so that it's one thing to talk about a new species. It's another to see a painting, say in the case of James's work, an 11 by 16 foot painting of a scene from 69 million years ago in northern Alaska showing a new species of dinosaur walking through a forest with the aurora going on up above and with other species and that we know of that live there, including the plants and other types of animals and birds. It's, you know, bringing that to life, it's not only just exciting for the public, it's exciting to us as scientists. It's a wonderful partnership, and it's been really enjoyable working with people like James and Ray to get these, to bring these animals to life. And without it, I think our science would be far less better able to communicate what we do and what we find.
And Pat, why don't you talk a little bit more about the exhibit that you have going on right now at the Museum of the North?
Oh yeah, happy to. This last May, we opened up a new exhibit called Expedition Alaska Dinosaurs. And this was an attempt to really bring to light a lot of the fossils that we've found of dinosaurs, and not just from the North Slope, but dinosaurs and even marine reptiles that lived during the Age of Dinosaurs. in Alaska and bringing these out into the public eye and showing everybody what we've been finding, what we've been doing, what are the stories, showing some skeletons of these animals, actual bones, we've attempted really to also tell the story of how we find these dinosaurs, what it's like to do field work. We have a life-size replica of one of our camp tents that kids can crawl into and do a bunch of hands-on activities inside. We have, I lost track. There's probably 6, 7, 8 video consoles that show what it's like to do field work in Southwest Alaska, Southeast Alaska, the North Slope, the Yukon River, things like this. So you get a real sense of what field conditions are like. And then to, raise a few questions, to talk a little bit about, well, hey, this is what we found. We don't know what it all means yet. And as Greg mentioned, we're working on that. And so here are some interesting questions, and here's the evidence, and what do you think? So that's what's going on. This exhibit will be on display at our museum through the winter, and I believe we will be having it on display throughout the next summer as well. So I'd encourage anybody who's got a particular predilection for paleontology to come on to Fairbanks to the Museum of the Rock, the Museum of the North, and have a look at our new dinosaur exhibit.
Great. Yeah, I'm hoping to bring my 5-year-old next summer.
Excellent.
We need to take one final quick break, but we'll have more on dinosaurs in Alaska as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
And by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Alaska Pacific University is accepting applications for all undergraduate programs for the spring 2016 semester. More at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. I'm Annie Feit, and today we are talking about dinosaurs in Alaska. Pat Druckenmiller and Greg Erickson join me. They are two experts on dinosaurs in Alaska. And Pat, or maybe Greg, you want to take this one? We've talked a lot about the Colville site, and we've mentioned a few other sites in Alaska, but can you kind of describe where are the other possible sites to find dinosaur bones in Alaska?
Well, we're basically finding dinosaur specimens all over Alaska. Denali Park has lots of dinosaur tracks, and a few bones and teeth have been found. I wasn't on this expedition, but Pat's crew found a remarkable track site on the Yukon, and down in southeast Alaska, Wasilla, for instance, has an armored dinosaur, an ankylosaur that was found there. So there seems to be dinosaurs all over the state. You just have to be in the right age sediment. And as Pat mentioned, there's also the sea monsters that lived, in the oceans or in the seas at the same time, and we're interested in those creatures as well. In fact, Pat is probably the world's leading expert on those animals. And basically, Alaska is fairly unexplored. It's hard to get to these places. There's not a lot of exposure, but if we get a tip that there's some bones coming out, we're obviously interested, and we're doing the best we can to explore it. And Pat and I intend to spend the rest of our careers up in Alaska searching for dinosaurs and sea monsters and other fossil creatures. And Pat, do you have anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, well, just to reinforce that, it's pretty amazing. We're always, maybe we shouldn't be surprised anymore, but anywhere we think that there are basically rocks from the age of the dinosaurs in Alaska, we're actually starting to find out there are, in fact, dinosaurs there as well. And we've explored really just a handful of sites. I think we're just still the tip of the iceberg in what we'll expect to find in the state in the coming years. So stay tuned. There'll be more fun, exciting discoveries to report, I'm sure.
Yeah, and we had an email come in. Are there any fossils to be found in South Central? So, I assume you would answer yes to that, but do you have any more specifics to that question?
Generally speaking, the real hotspot for in South Central would be the Talkeetna Mountains area, and it's only a part of the Talkeetna Mountains that has a variety of different sites there. As Anne mentioned, there was this thing we call the Talkeetna Mountains Hadrosaur that was discovered there and excavated by Anne and Kevin May at our museum. There is the Ankylosaur, it's an armored dinosaur that Greg mentioned as well. This last summer, we actually excavated part of a marine reptile called a plesiosaur, or more specifically, an elasmosaur. These are the Loch Ness monster-looking creatures that, mm-hmm. with really long nets, that we excavated from the Talkeetnas as well. So that's really the main area in South Central.
And Pat, you say that rivers are highways when looking for fossils. Can you kind of explain what you mean by that?
Sure. It's kind of fun that, of course, we, as Alaskans, we all know that the highway system's rather limited in the state, but the at least the paved highways, the highways of really of the last many hundreds, if not thousands of years by people who've lived here are the rivers. And we rely on those heavily today. And for two reasons. One, it's often the only way we can use to get to particular areas to do our work in the first place. For example, when we made these discoveries of dinosaur tracks on the Yukon River, to get there, and they're way the heck over by downriver from Galena, we actually put in our boats in Fairbanks on the Tanana River, and then we went 500 miles down the river, down the Tanana and then the Yukon River to reach the field site. And then the other important thing about rivers is that they're also the mechanism, the tool, if you will, that is responsible for cutting through the rocks and exposing the rocks, because most of the state's either covered in forest or tundra. If we want to see the rocks underneath, we need to find exposures, and the river cuts are really the best place to do that. So we rely heavily on river cut areas, especially like along the Colville, along the Yukon River, to find our fossils. So they're highways, for exploration, if you will.
And do you have tips for people who want to look for fossils in Alaska? And is that something you would encourage people to do?
I think the first and most important tip about that is it's great. I think, first of all, many of the most exciting dinosaur finds in the history all over the world have not been made by paleontologists. They've been made by people who are out hunting, who are out fishing, who are out hiking. And so I encourage people to keep their eyes open when they're floating down rivers themselves or out hiking somewhere. The important point there is that is really relates to the ownership of the fossil. And in Alaska, the fossil belongs to whoever owns that land. And because most of the state is state, you know, it's federally owned or owned by the state, those fossils are owned by the state or the federal government. Our museum, the Museum of the North, is a repository for both the state and the federal agencies. So I would say if somebody does find something, the best thing to do is to take some photographs of it, to take a GPS point of it, and then you can contact me at the museum, and I'm happy, and I do this frequently, look at photos and tell you, can give you an idea of what you found. And if you're not sure whose land you're on, we can also help work with that as well. And then if it's actually a find that we're interested in, and we've done this before, we'll make arrangements and try to go out and check it out. So we're really... I think we've done a pretty good job of giving credit where credit's due. So if you find a new species of dinosaur, we'd, you never know. You might get a dinosaur named after you or something like that. So
that would be really cool.
Yeah.
We have another caller on the line, Wassily from Southwest Alaska. Hello. You're on Talk of Alaska.
Hello. I have one question. Has the woolly mammoth coexisted with the dinosaurs in Alaska?
Oh, question, yeah. Did woolly mammoths and dinosaurs coexist? And the answer to that is no. The woolly mammoth was sort of the icon of the last ice age, which they were running around Alaska for the last, say, couple hundred thousand to, say, maybe 8,000 years ago in Alaska. Dinosaurs that we're talking about were living in Alaska about, they all died off by 66 million years ago. So dinosaurs and mammoths never coexisted. Of course, we see they're both big, charismatic, large animals, and oftentimes they, unfortunately, sometimes appear in books side by side as if they coexisted, but they lived at very, very different periods of time.
And woolly mammoth tusks are easier to find in Alaska than dinosaur bones, or harder?
Yeah.
Hard to say?
Yes, absolutely. There are literally hundreds of thousands of Ice Age mammal fossil finds in Alaska. This is actually, and that's subject, I'm sure, for a whole nother show about the great finds of Ice Age mammals in Alaska. It's a fantastic place for that, primarily as a result of our particularly the interior of Alaska, its mining history. And those early miners that used hydraulic methods to strip down the hillsides also were basically doing the perfect job of exposing bones from all these different kinds of Ice Age mammals like mammoths and horses and steppe bison and all sorts of crazy things like that.
Okay, I'm going to read another email here and try to pronounce a dinosaur name. Therizinosaur? Is that an herbivore or a carnivore? The skull at the Flagstaff Arizona Museum has peg-like teeth, but lately I've heard some people are saying it's a meat eater.
Greg, do you want to take that one?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. Therizinosaurs are kind of what we call, they're kind of enigmatic theropod dinosaurs. In other words, the theropod dinosaurs were meat-eating dinosaurs. But the therizinosaurs are kind of interesting because they're in that group, but their teeth are clearly look more like plant eaters' teeth. And so we think we have a dinosaur here that's basically reverted to eating plants, or at least omnivory, in other words, plants and animals. This is, you know, not unprecedented today. If you think about it, bears are a good example. They're essentially omnivores. The polar bear, of course, is a very good carnivore, pure meat eater. But most bears, such as the brown bears and black bears, eat lots of plants and berries and things like that, and occasionally some meat as well. And their teeth are actually are not very well suited for eating meat, for that matter. They're actually somewhat more like our teeth if you look at their molars. And so the therizinosaur seems to be a similar kind of creature, an animal that's reverted back to eating plants and maybe some animals as well.
Okay, well, we are running out of time here, but Pat, I wanted to ask you, what are the best dinosaur questions you get from kids who are visiting the museum?
Well, that's a good question. When we were developing our exhibit, we put out a little stand where people had an opportunity to ask questions about dinosaurs and what kind of things they would like to know about dinosaurs in an exhibit. I think several of the things that were most commonly asked had to do with, how did these dinosaurs live way the heck up north? That was common from both adults and kids. Mm-hmm. And it is kind of a strange thought to think of. What we think of as these scaly, reptile-y things standing around shivering in the cold. But questions like that. And
we might have to leave it there. Thanks to my guest today, Greg Erickson, a paleobiologist at Florida State University, Pat Druckenmiller from UAF's University, the Alaska Museum of the North.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Crowley, providing marine petroleum distribution and energy support services throughout Alaska since 1953, supporting business development while helping safeguard the environment. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at ArcticWireRope.com. And by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on Condor.com. Condor, born to fly. The Alaska Marine Conservation Council reminds Alaskans to choose local, sustainably caught seafood when dining out or in. More information at akmarine.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Marine Conservation Council. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.